Welcome to Dev 322 HTML and 5 Windows 8 applications. Helps if I turn on my clicker. Yeah. My name is Aaron Powell. I'm a web developer by trade. I work for a company called Redify as a senior developer. It's other contact information if you want to get a hold of me. And I wrote a Windows 8 application called Pinboard in HTML5 and JavaScript. And today I'm going to talk to you about my experiences, things that I learned, and hopefully we're going to make sure you don't go through the same pains. So through this talk, I'm going to kind of break it down into three primary sections. First off, we're going to talk about how to approach Windows 8 development with HTML5 and JavaScript. Let's talk about some problems that I came across, some things that you really got to watch out for that really burnt me badly when I was writing my application. And I'm going to finish off with some limitations that I've come across that you should be aware of when you're approaching Windows 8 development using HTML5 and JavaScript. So first off, we'll just have a look at how we can approach development of Windows 8 and HTML5 applications with Windows 8. So this was the first thing that I thought of when I started building my application. I'd seen all the demos and everyone was just taking like their website and then opening it up in Windows, in Visual Studio and putting a JS proj file and it was just working. So I'm not sure if it's a website or if it's an application. Well, you're not really building a website. This was one of the first mistakes that I made when I approached my application that I was building, that I tried to build it like a website. What do I mean when it's not a website? Well, really, you're creating a desktop application. It just happens to be that HTML is your markup language instead of XAML. Your code behind is JavaScript instead of C#. So you've got to approach it using those mentalities rather than I'm building a web page and I've got the standard kind of web paradigm behind it. Some of the web rules that we're used to when building websites and applications that run natively within the browser don't necessarily apply. And if you try and force some of those rules into it, it can actually be very complex with inside of your application. Things such as the way navigation works is a primary example of things that you've got to watch out for and make sure you take into consideration when building a Windows 8 application using HTML and JavaScript. Another thing is network latency. Generally speaking, you're not going to be pulling things over the network. Your CSS, HTML, and JavaScript are all bundled into an APX file that is installed into your into the user's environment, so you don't have to go out and fetch these files over a network. So you don't have that network latency, which means that if you've got 50 files, you don't need to worry about downloading 50 files. They're all on disk. So you don't need to worry about things like minification and combination engines like you would when you're building a website. Also, we don't have just the traditional page events. I mean, sure, we've got DOM content ready, DOM content loaded and stuff like that within a Windows 8 application, but that's actually a very unimportant event within the scope of a Windows 8 application. And I'm going to talk a bit more about those eventing a bit later on in more detail. So these are some really crucial points as why it's not actually a website that you're building in Windows 8. You're building an application that just happens to use web technologies. Another thing you've got to remember is that there is only one engine that is going to be running this code. It's Triton and Chakra, the IE rendering engine for CSS and HTML, and the IE JScript engine. Those are the two that you've got to target, which means that you don't need to worry about vendor prefixes. Don't put a dash WebKit in there. You're never going to display this in a WebKit engine. So there's no need for that. Generally speaking, there's not going to be a need for prefixed usage within your CSS or your JavaScript. I can't think of anything from the JavaScript side that is unprefixed now that RTM has been released. And the only things that you'll probably come across that you'll need to prefix are the very specific Windows 8 things, such as a media query against a snapped versus a full screen portrait view, things like that. They're only concepts that are valid with inside Windows 8, so that's the only time you're going to need a prefix for it. So this was the next thing that I came across. I'm a web developer. The first thing I do is install jQuery. I see that I'm writing JavaScript. I'm going to have jQuery installed. Well, you don't need jQuery if you're building a Windows 8 application. This could sound like sacrilege. I mean, who does JavaScript development today without installing jQuery into their page? Well, the reason you don't need jQuery is one of the goals of jQuery was to normalize the different browser quirks. The way events were registered across the different browser engines, the way AJAX worked, so you didn't have to think about that kind of stuff. You just had one single API that you were working with. But remember, this code is never going to execute across multiple browser engines. It's going to be only through the IE engine. So you don't need to worry about how IE6 was wiring up events. I mean, you're never going to put this through the IE6 engine. Some other things that you'll generally be looking for jQuery to do is CSS selectors. Sizzle, which is the CSS selector engine in jQuery, is very powerful, and it was designed to replace or to supplement the fact that browsers didn't have a good built-in CSS selector engine. This has been included since IE9 in the query selector all has been there since IE9, and WinJS also has some APIs that allow you to do some cleverer things, things such as add and remove CSS classes, or even toggle CSS classes. Querying on just the ID specifically versus querying across an entire CSS selector. Things like that are actually built into the winjs.utils API, and that comes out of the box with the WinJS API. So a lot of the things that we look to jQuery to do are already natively within inside of WinJS. So we don't need jQuery to supplement them. You do lose some things, obviously, by not having jQuery, particularly from the selector engine point of view. Custom selectors, so if you want to write your own custom way of doing a CSS selector, you can't do that, obviously, if you're not using jQuery. But to be honest, I can't remember the last time I actually had a need to do that, because you've got CSS3 selectors, which can generally supplement the majority of things that you're going to be wanting to do with a custom CSS selector anyway. The last thing that I generally look to jQuery to do is animations. So jQuery does have a really good animations library built into it. It's got a great community extensions around animations, but a lot of these are very based in CPU. They use JavaScript to manipulate the position of an element on screen to perform a particular animation. Problem is that jQuery being JavaScript being single-threaded, you're kind of locked to, if that animation is running, it's difficult to do other things at the same time. Your application can slow down, potentially if you've got really big, complex animations that are happening. So this has been replaced by CSS3. CSS3 has a really good animation engine in it, and by using that instead of jQuery's animations, you actually get the advantages of hardware support, and that it gets handled by the GPU instead of the CPU. So your animations can happen a lot faster, and they can be done without blocking any other user interaction that you may want to do within your page, or inside of your application. These are, yes, also common web tips as well, not just specific to Windows 8, HTML5, and application development, but it's very important to know these when you're approaching a Windows 8 application. The next thing is patterns. Like .NET, you really should be using some good, solid design patterns when producing an application. I kind of don't have a lot of patterns inside of my application because it wasn't until I was that far down the rabbit hole that I went, oh, I'm really making a mess of my code base. It's really starting to become unmaintainable. And I'm slowly putting these back in. So as long as you're aware of some of the good patterns to use up front, you can save yourself a lot of headaches later on. So one of the primary patterns that I recommend using is namespacing. This is, it's not a new thing in web development. Namespacing has been around since, I think, MS Ajax 1.0, I think, had it in there. So we're talking 5 years since it was in the Microsoft stack, and it's been around, obviously, a lot longer than that. But WinJS has a built-in way that you can generate namespaces. And a namespace is a great way of scoping your code blocks to particular areas. The same way that we would do namespacing with inside of a .NET application. There's a logical reason why we do it in .NET. Use those same logical principles when you're producing a HTML5 and JavaScript application in Windows 8. Another design pattern that I think is very important to be looking into, and if you look at some of the samples for Windows 8 applications, they do have this pattern used a bit. It's called the module pattern. There's a couple of variations of it, such as the revealing module. And you've probably come across it if you've done web development. But the goal of it is you have a single a self-executing function, so an anonymous function that never gets used outside of an immediate executing scope. And then what you do is you pass into that any dependencies this function is going to require. So this is kind of like hand-rolled IOC, if you really want to kind of equate it to that, that you have a module that's doing something very specific, you pass in what it's going to require to do that very specific feature, and then it is finished and it either exposes things that it needs to expose or it doesn't expose things if it doesn't have to. So this is really good to enforce a single responsibility pattern to make sure that you don't have like a 100-line function that is doing 10 different things and basically making it very difficult to work out where your code is. Another advantage of modules is, as I said, you don't have network latency like you do within the web, building websites or applications that run in the browser. So you can split these over heaps of files and have like really small specific files for the things that you need to do because you don't have network latency that's going to take a long time to download each of these files. So this is what the module pattern looks like for anyone that hasn't used it before. Essentially, you have this self-executing anonymous function at the top. So we have round brackets and then the function straight after it. I've passed in a dependency, so this is taking a dependency on a tasks object that I've got inside of my application. And then that is passed into the function, and then I can do something with inside of that. So I'm just going to bring up a code demo, or a little code example. So this is from with inside of, find the right file. With inside of one of my my Pinboard project. So here I'm using the module pattern. I've got a global object that I'm passing in, which is starting at the top, and then I do a whole bunch of stuff internally, create some APIs, and then ultimately, right down the very bottom here, I expose that by assigning it into the global object. What I've also got here is an example of some of the Windows utilities for doing jQuery-style interactions. So one thing I really like about jQuery that I did miss from not having jQuery inside of my application is the way that you can just chain methods together, and that's a very, very nice the way that you can design your JavaScript, and the WinJS API isn't quite as nice as that. So I wrote a little library called aQuery that does a lot of those things, and internally, all it's doing is passing that down into the WinJS APIs so that I've got the programming model that I'm comfortable with, that I'm used to working against, but internally, I'm getting the advantage of doing things that is native into the WinJS API itself. So if we wanted to take the module pattern one step further, we could look at using dependency loaders. There's two really popular dependency loaders at the moment. One's called require.js, the other's curl.js. Both of them are very similar. They have a very similar API. And essentially what these are IOC containers for JavaScript. They're not kind of IOC containers that you might be familiar with, say, AutoFac or Ninject or any of the others that are out there for .NET. But they're the best that you can kind of get with inside of JavaScript. So this is how you would use require.js. So I've got a API somewhere called data that might be, say, doing some Ajax or something like that, and I'm passing in a dependency that could be called jQuery. So the first thing I do is I use this define function. Then I pass in an array of dependencies that are going to be required within inside of this module that I'm working with. What require and curl will do is they will go off, they will fetch all these dependencies, make sure that they are loaded in the appropriate order, and then pass in the objects that they create into the module function here. So into here I get the dollars, which represents the first item inside of my array, so on and so forth if I had multiples. Then later on, I can have a requires method, which says, this is not going to return anything. This is just going to execute something. So a define will return something. A require will just take something and execute it. So here it says, I want task.data, which is this file up here. So require.js will go out, it will find this file, it will include it into the browser, or into the application. It will then get the result of that. It will then pass that in as an argument, so I get my data API passed in, and then inside of my module, I can work against my data API. So I haven't had to think about, well, have I got the scripts registered in the correct order within inside of my HTML file? It's being done on my behalf. One thing to note about dependency loaders, though, is you want to avoid using a dependency loader to directly inject the Windows 8 JavaScript APIs, so the WinJS APIs. They're not designed to work in a, in the script loaders, so they're not designed with like defines preceding them and things like that. So if you try and load them directly using the script loaders, you're going to run into problems. What is a better idea is you actually wrap them. So you just include them normally as you would get out of the project templates, and then you wrap them to expose them as dependencies with inside of your application. So this would be, say, how I wanted to expose WinJS, the root namespace, as a dependency that I could consume. And then if I want just the class part of that, I could have another defines function that is just for the class that has a dependency on WinJS and then exposes just the WinJS.class API. So next I want to talk about classes. I'm not up here to talk about classical inheritance versus prototypal inheritance. We can do that over a beer later tonight or something, but be aware that there is a reason that JavaScript doesn't have classes built into the language yet, but there is also a reason that you might want classes with inside of the language. WinJS, as we saw on the previous slide, has an API for doing this. So it gives you an out-of-the-box way of creating classes. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of libraries out there that will create JavaScript classes for you. It's just, it's in there in the framework, so you don't have to go out there and fetch one and find it and choose whatever you want. And the one that's built in is actually really quite intelligent about the way that it does it. But why would you actually want to use classes? Well, classes can be useful, particularly if you're doing models with inside of your application. Say you're building a game in HTML and JavaScript. You probably have different types, like a player and the environment that they're interacting with, that you might want to be able to create unique instances of, and that's a really good reason for using classes with inside of your JavaScript. So this is how you would create a class using the WinJS API. As you'll see, I'm using the require.js to import that class dependency that I created a few slides ago. And you'll see here that class is actually a reserved word in the JavaScript language, so although there isn't technically class support, there is a reserved keyword called class. Yeah, go JavaScript. So I've called it class with a K as the argument that's being passed into my module. Inside of that, I use class.define, and the first thing that I do is I pass in a function that is going to act as my constructor. Here I can set up any initial values that I'm going to be requiring on my object, set up any internal state that the object is going to be wanting to use. And then the second argument to this is public members that I want to create on my object. So here I've just got some basic properties. I've got a name, a description, and whether or not a task has been done. So I set them to some default values, they get created, and everything will be exciting. If you want to do internal members or private members, all you need to do is prefix it with an underscore, and the WinJS API will see, well, you've got an underscore on this, I'm going to make that as private as possibly can on what is technically a public member in a JavaScript object. By private, what I mean is you won't be able to enumerate over it. If you try and ask what are all the properties of this type, it won't return that type. So there is some advantages to doing that, particularly if you want to hide things from external consumption. Also, if you want to provide a bit more logic behind your properties, say you want to have something happen when a value is set, or you want to do a calculated value as the return instead of just a single, essentially public field as you would here, you can provide that as a JavaScript object with get and set functions on it inside of this second argument to the define method, and that will then create it with a get and a set property using the ECMAScript 5 property getter and setter API as well. So, as I said, it's got a lot of smarts about the way that it will be able to define your classes and allow you to have a lot of power behind the classes that you are creating if and when you require classes with inside of your application. These C-sharp developers have been raving for like the last 6 months or something about this new async keyword. Ooh, we can do async programming a whole lot easier. JavaScript developers, like, we've been doing that for like 10 years. It's been pretty easy. Don't know what you guys are all on about. I mean, everything in JavaScript is asynchronous. What does the first A in AJAX stand for? Well, if you're doing animations, they're generally asynchronous as well. You don't want to be blocking the user while your animation slides in, while your slide deck slides in from the right here. Event handlers, well, they're inherently asynchronous as well. You don't actually have real control over the scope of where they've come from. Timers are asynchronous, so we've already had all this asynchronous programming built in JavaScript. I'm not sure what the C# guys are all raving on about. But ultimately, when you're doing async programming, you want to make it simple. You want to make it consistent, and you want to make it easy to discover. This is obviously one advantage of the C# async keyword. It makes it really easy to do asynchronous programming without having to think about it. So ultimately, we want the same thing in JavaScript. We want to be able to react when something succeeds or fails, and we want to do it in a consistent way. That's ultimately what we want to do. We don't want to have to learn, well, if I'm doing an AJAX request, I've got to provide it as an argument, the second argument for the success function, but if I'm doing an animation, there's a callback argument that I've got to set in the arguments that I'm passing, or anything like that. You don't want to have to think about that. You want it to be nice and simple the way that it wires up. So let's start with AJAX. AJAX is probably the most common type of asynchronous programming that you're going to be doing in Windows 8, or probably in any kind of JavaScript development. So WinJS has this XHR on its root namespace, which, again, there's no need for jQuery here. You don't really need the jQuery.ajax or jQuery.get or anything like that. It's built in, and it's going to natively use the object with inside the browser. It's not going to try and spin up ActiveX controls or anything like that. So it's also faster as well, because you don't have to do those checks that jQuery would inherently be doing. But something to note about the WinJS XHR API is it's a lot rawer than you're probably used to if you've been working with jQuery or any of the other popular JavaScript libraries out there. Particularly if you're wanting to do post requests, you've got to really control the headers to make sure that you're setting the appropriate, that it's a form encoded and that's how you're passing up the fields and anything like that. So it's a little bit raw in that regard. Also, if you're doing the response that you get back doesn't get parsed into, say, a nice JSON format that you can then just enumerate through the properties, you kind of got to do that yourself. This is obviously a great option for anyone that wants to write an open source project, just a nice little wrapper so we get some of that features done nicely. Anyone? Worth a try. But what one thing I was saying is that we want our asynchronous programming to all look the same. So there's an API inside of WinJS called the Promise API. It's not WinJS specific, it's been around for a while, but ultimately it is designed to make sure that any asynchronous programming has the same exposed contracts, that when you provide it with a success callback, that it's going to look the same regardless of whether you're doing an AJAX request or an animation or calling a timeout or anything like that. So this is how you use it in this example with the AJAX API. So what it does is the promise returns an object that has a couple of functions on it. The most basic of the functions is the then function, and for then you pass it a success, a failure, and you can also pass it an optional, or they're all optional technically. You can pass it a third argument, which is a progress. It's actually used internally with inside the XHR API so that you can have a callback that's executed every time the ready state changes of your AJAX request, not just when it succeeds or fails. So the idea is to have an API that's consistent across that. It also exposes a couple other methods, such as done and I think it's fail. So if you want to just specifically provide a done handler, then it's possible that way. You can also add multiple callbacks in this regard. So you can have multiple functions executed when a success happens or when a failure happens. So when you're implementing the Promise API yourself, it would look something like this. So I've just created a function called doStuff up here. Doesn't really do anything of interest. And what I'm doing is I'm returning a new instance of winjs.promise. So that's the API that I'm talking about. And the first thing that we pass in is a function that has up to three arguments can be provided to it. You've got a success callback handler, a failure callback handler, and the progress callback handler. Inside this, I just wanted to illustrate how you could wrap kind of any arbitrary bit of asynchronous programming with inside a promise. Here I'm just using a set timeout, and then after 1,000 milliseconds, it's going to execute the success method, pass in a message, and then somewhere else in my API, I could call doStuff.done and then pass in the callback handler that I want to execute. So with inside of my Pinboard application, I actually use promises quite a bit. So if I can just find the right file. Okay, so here is how I go out and I query and get all the bookmarks that I need to display onto the UI for the user. So you'll see here that in the get all method, what I'm doing is I'm creating a new WinJS promise, I return that, and then I'm doing a query out to my server, and then when it executes, it's going to be returning me a function that, it's going to return me some data that I can then pass through to my complete handler. So as you can see also, this server.query API, it's not actually returning a promise kind of in the way that I'm wanting to be consistent throughout my application. So this is again why I can wrap it nicely. I don't have to care about the way this asynchronous programming is being done by the third party. I just care about the way that my application is going to consume it, and I want that to be consistent across across multiple areas. Now, the way that I would use that is, if I just scroll down a bit here. So the way that I use that here is inside of my search method, on line 134 and 136, I'm calling out to pinboard.data.getAll, and then on line 139, I'm using the promise that gets returned from that, and then doing .then, and when that successfully completes, I then want to call another method within my application. So here I'm kind of abstracting away the inconsistent asynchronous programming model that I'm working with and making it consistent with inside of my application so that I always work with this then or done handlers. So what about storage? Chances are you're going to want to store some data with inside of your Windows 8 application. So we've got various different ways that we can store data. We've got local storage, roaming storage, we've got some security storage available to us, and we've also got offline storage. So local and roaming storage are essentially key value pairs that give us access to a store that's kind of stored within the scope of just our particular application. Local storage is, they're kind of called local setting and roaming settings, so they're more designed to be used for settings, and local storage is stored on the device, so if you uninstall the application, you'll lose any settings that are there. It does persist across upgrading of your application, so don't fret about that kind of stuff. I mean, if someone uninstalls the application, then installs a new version, you're going to lose those values, but you can use that pretty much for anything that you would be wanting for just a local installed version of settings. Roaming, on the other hand, allows you to store against the cloud. I'm pretty sure it syncs against your live ID, so I'm not 100% sure how it's going to work if you're not signed into a Windows 8 device using a live ID. I'm not quite sure how roaming storage is going to deal with that. And essentially, it's the same kind of programming model as you get with local storage, except it can be synced across multiple devices. So this can be really useful if your settings need to be shared between the different devices. Some things to note about the local and roaming storage. The keys, the name of the key can only be, it can be a maximum of 255 characters long. I'm sure if you're breaking 255 characters, you've probably got a bad name for the property that you're trying to store. You can only store up to 8 kilobytes of data against each value. Again, if you're blowing that out, you've probably got other problems that you should be addressing. And you can only store up to 64K of data against either of the storage models, either the local or the roaming. So again, 64K of data is quite a bit when this is essentially a text-based key-value pair. Also, the data for particularly local storage is stored in the registry. Another project I worked on, we had this as a bit of a concern from the client because, well, it's kind of unencrypted stuff in the registry from what we were able to find out. So just be aware of that as well. If your application has got to deal with like NSA level encryption or anything like that, might be something that you want to watch out for. So this is how you would use the local and roaming settings. So off the windows.storage.applicationdata.current API. Yeah, we got these enormous namespaces within some of WinJS. So you've got either a local or roaming settings object that you can access off that. Don't try and construct these objects yourself. I think they do expose in a way that you could potentially construct them. Don't construct them yourself. You don't want to try and own the life cycle of settings. That's a very bad idea. But it's, like I said, it's a key value store, and it's really, really ideal to work in JavaScript with key value stores. You just do dot some property and then assign it, and then all of a sudden it's being created. Then if you want to get it, so you access the dot values dot some other property, and then you can get out of local or roaming. So some scenarios where local storage might be ideal would be if you've got, or the way that I use it inside my application is that I want to know when I last queried out to the external server to download some information. So I store that on the device. Because I don't want, if someone's got this installed across multiple devices, I don't want them to not be able to sync on one device because, well, it says you've already synced recently. Synced? That doesn't sound right. Synced recently. But that was on the other device. So if you store that locally to the device, that's an ideal usage for it. Roaming, on the other hand, could be something that you want persisted across the multiple ways that the user interacts with the application. I use this for prompting to delete a tag with inside of the application. I don't want the user to have to say on this device I don't want the user to have the option to say on this device I want to prompt to delete, and this device I don't. I just want that to be consistent across all the devices that have my application installed on. So some scenarios that the different storage models can be ideal for. So what about security? This was something that I completely missed when I first started my application, is I needed to store a username and password. So how do you do that? Well, you probably don't want to write your own. That's a bad idea. You really don't want to be writing your own security stuff. Luckily, you want to. If you want to store anything else that's secure that you maybe want to hide behind an additional protection layer in Windows, a username and password of the Windows user and stuff like that. Well, luckily, there's an API available with inside WinJS. It's called Password Vault. And what this does is it accesses the Windows web credential store. So if you actually go into your computer and type credentials, I think it is under settings, you'll be able to get to all the settings that are stored in the secure storage with inside of Windows. And that's where you write to with inside of your application. It allows you to store two values, a username and a password. The username is stored in a way that you can read by just opening up the credentials manager. The password requires a second login to the machine, so you need to, if you try and reveal the password, you then are prompted for the user's Windows machine password, again, to access it. And these are scoped to just your application, so you can store as many of these as you want for just your application. And it's good if you want to add an additional layer of security within inside of that. So this is how the password vault looks. It's windows.security.credentials.passwordvault. You've got to create an instance of that, and that you kind of keep around for the lifetime of your application, so it's sort of a singleton. You need to give it a key which represents the credentials that you're storing for your application. And the way that you access something is you would say passwordvault.findByResource, which is the key that identifies your application, and that will return you an array of the credentials that are stored against this particular key for your application. If you want to create something, you use the password credentials API, and then that takes the key, a username, and a password. These don't have to be a username and password. It's just kind of two text values. A username and password is obviously a logical use for it. And then you tell the password vault to add those credentials. So I use this inside my application. Oops, not that one. It's one of these. Ah, it's the last one. Of course, it's the very last one I click on. So here's how I use it with inside. What you'll actually notice is that I'm doing on lines 14 and 15, I actually do two queries into the password vault. The first one is a get by resource, and then the second one is a retrieve. So if you want the username and password, you have to do two queries to it. So this is an additional layer of security built into the API. The first object that you get back will have a password property of it, but it will always be blank. And it's not until you do a second query for that particular username or whatever is stored within that username property will you be able to access the user's password with inside your application. Again, it's kind of like the double login check that it's got if you go to it through just the Windows UI. That's how you can access it. And then down the bottom, you'll see that I create keys, and I'm using the namespace API to expose this. I have a pinboard.authentication API that I can work against with inside of my application. Only if you, so there was a question, do you need a hash or anything to encrypt the key? Not unless you want to add that layer of encryption yourself. By default, Windows will just store it in the as you give it. So if you put your own level of, if you put your own hash and salt on top of it, it will store it with that hash and salt and things like that. This is great for storing credentials, but you've got to kind of take it with a bit of caution that it is still technically plain text. And if someone can log into the device and knows your username and password, they will be able to get to all these secure credentials. I think you've got a bigger problem if someone can do that, that you probably need to address, but that's my personal opinion on the matter. So what about offline storage? So settings, as I said, you've got finite limits. You can store up to 64K, which, it's still a lot of data, but it's still technically a key value store, and it's not great to query against or anything like that. What if you want to store something that is more than 64K worth of data, or you want a better programming model to be able to query against it? In my example, I need to be able to search against the data that I was storing. You don't really have access to a SQL server. I haven't looked extensively enough to see if there is a WinJS API that it will interact with the SQL server. I'm pretty sure there isn't. And if there was, I would be pretty sure I'd never use it. The idea of querying a SQL server from JavaScript is just scary to me. Instead, we can use IndexedDB. And that's the recommended way if you want to be storing large amounts of data. So what's IndexedDB? IndexedDB is part of HTML5. It's built into all the top-level browsers now. IE10 was kind of the last one to bring it in. It's kind of flaky across some of the other browsers, but in IE10 is actually the best implementation that I've worked with. And it's essentially an asynchronous storage API that is SQL-like. So it's close to a NoSQL database, but I'm not entirely convinced that it is a fully NoSQL database, but it's also definitely not a SQL server. It does have things that you'll be familiar with if from SQL server programming, like keys and indexes and transactions and all those kinds of fun things that we want, but it is technically a NoSQL database. So just some notes on the amount of data that you can store with IndexedDB. IE10 has a limit of 10 meg that you'll be able to store against it. Initially, once you hit the 10 meg, it will then prompt you to whether or not you want to allow the application to store more. It will then allow it to grow up to 250 meg in size, so you can store pretty much as all the data that you could possibly need. It does start scaling out, particularly if you've got larger hard disks. It will go up to, it will allow you to store up to 4% of the total capacity of your hard drive with IndexedDB data. So, you can store a hell of a lot of data inside of this API if you need. Wouldn't necessarily recommend it though. So I'll just bring up, so this is an API that I wrote. It's called db.js, and it aims to improve the way that you could interact with IndexedDB. This is not specific for Windows 8 development, but I wrote it for Windows 8 development, so I don't really know how well it works in all the different browsers. Without going kind of too deep into the way it works, the first thing you need to do is access the IndexedDB object here. Make sure that you get it unvendor prefixed. As I said, in Windows 8 applications, you don't need to worry about vendor prefixing, but because this isn't specific to Windows 8, it kind of does. So here, I just expose a couple of different APIs that work with creating transactions, allowing you to insert data, allowing you to query data. And this is kind of why I was also saying you should look at promises to keep consistent interactions with asynchronous, because all this does is it exposes a series of events like on error, on success, on complete, and stuff like that. So you've just got event handlers, which can be really tedious to wire up, and it's not consistent. I don't know of any other JavaScript API that exposes just an on error event. So promises are a great way to kind of abstract some of that kind of stuff away. Okay, so next up, background processing. So I would really strongly recommend you look into web workers if you're going to be doing anything that's quite CPU intensive. Things such as games are ideal for web workers, where you can palm off just computational logic, processing where things need to be relative to other other things on on the canvas and stuff like that. The reason why Web Workers is so useful, particularly in Windows 8 applications, is because it allows you to use multiple threads. JavaScript is a single-threaded engine, so if you don't share that across multiple, if you don't try and split your logic over multiple threads, and you've got really intensive CPU interactions happening, it can slow down your application. One ideal scenario for this is if you've got for a non-game scenario, if you've got unimportant data that you want to load asynchronously, you just chuck the AJAX request into a web worker, and then just have that kind of spinning in the background and then pumping the data back into your application. So here's how you would use a web worker inside of a Windows 8 application. Because you don't have a browser, really, you don't have URLs that you navigate to. Instead, we use this ms-appx, colon whack whack, as the scheme to locate the file. So here I've just got a folder called JS and a worker.js file with inside of that. And we use, the appx URI scheme to locate that file. And I can then, add event listeners and listen for messages coming back from my worker and things like that. So what about tombstoning? This is particularly important if you're doing background operations. You want to make sure that when you've got background operations or kind of any operations that are happening inside of your application that could be taking a while, you want to make sure that you're listening for the on checkpoint event that gets fired by WinJS. This is what I was talking about by Windows 8 has its own event model that is available with inside that is not familiar to web developers because we don't have these events. So what will happen is the on checkpoint event gets raised when your application is tombstoned, like when lids get shut on laptops, when tablets go to sleep, things like that, or even when you just navigate away from your application, it goes into a background. Anyone that's done phone development will be familiar with tombstoning. So the ideal thing inside of this is you capture the on checkpoint event, and then if you've got any web workers, you use you tell them to shut down, so you send a message to them to tell them to close, and then you use the set promise API to kind of sit there and wait for that and make sure that the checkpoint event doesn't think that it's finished before everything's completed. So again, just exposing your own promises into set promise, which comes as an argument to the checkpoint event. Also, make sure that any kind of asynchronous programming that you may happen or any background processes that you've got that you're trying to shut down, make sure they don't take too long, because Windows 8 will just terminate your application if it takes too long to shut down, to go into sleep mode. It will just kill it and you get errors in your event logs and the application is essentially classed as a crash. So here's an example of how you could use the on checkpoint event with a web worker. So again, I've just got that web worker kind of sitting in the background. It's got it's doing whatever the heck that it wants to do, and the checkpoint event has fired with inside of my application, so I need it to stop doing what it's doing. So I use the event argument that gets passed in, .detail.setPromise. So here I provide it with a new promise that I'm creating. I'm adding an event listener to my web worker just specifically for this scenario, for the shutdown. And then I post a message to it, telling it to shut down. And when it sends back a response saying that it has shut down successfully, I then call the done method for my promise, and that then tells Windows 8 that cool, you can class my application as shut down. It's safe to close the process off. So that's some tips on how to kind of approach the development of your Windows 8 HTML and JavaScript applications. So let's talk about some things that really burnt me. The first thing is don't look at the DOM. I did this, and you probably can't see this up in the back, but this is what part of my DOM looked like. This is for a semantic zoom control. And yes, that's about 12-point font, and that is a hell of a lot of nested divs, inline CSS, and pretty much everything that we've been told is horrible about the web. So some things you've got to remember about the DOM in Windows 8 is that although we are working with HTML, that we are technically in a browser engine, we're not really working with the web the way that we're used to working with the web. You'll find a lot of auto-generated HTML, particularly from the built-in controls for Windows 8. And one of the reasons why that they have built-in controls, why they auto-generate the HTML for you, is to make sure that it's consistent across all the devices. And often if you look at it, the HTML just simply does not make sense. The semantic zoom HTML just blew my mind when I first was trying to inspect it. The headers are actually at the bottom of the div set, and I'm like, I don't understand where this HTML... And then I realized everything was absolutely positioned, and that's why it was actually working. I was like, oh, okay. So, kind of, don't worry about what the DOM looks like. No one's really going to see your DOM. No one can right-click and view source inside of a Windows 8 application, so you don't have to worry about just how ugly the DOM really is. So, with controls, there's a lot of... you'll probably be familiar with just a lot of existing controls, particularly jQuery extensions and things like that. Don't use them. One of the main reasons that you probably shouldn't look to using these is that they're not designed with the Windows 8 style guidelines behind it. But it's a very valid point that these things are designed to work in an environment that is different to the environment that your application is going to be delivered in. It's got a different UX paradigm behind it, things like that. So ideally, you want to avoid existing controls that are designed for websites when you're trying to build a Windows 8 application. Instead, stick with the ship controls. The ship controls are actually really quite good. I was pleasantly surprised when I worked with them. You've got the kind of common things that you're going to be needing to work with, such as lists and grids and semantic zoom, data sources, things like that. They're already built in. HTML5 input fields have got built-in number control. The number control I don't think made it into Windows 8 or IE10 yet. But it's got email fields, URL fields, and things like that, which will force the keyboard to be in a particular state for you, so you don't have to worry about that kind of thing anyway. So kind of look to what's already there before you try and look for what you think you're going to need. It's not difficult to write your own control either for Windows 8 in the JavaScript space, so that's obviously an ideal other option is you could build your own control if you find something that is not limited. There's also a couple of companies out there that are producing controls for Windows 8, so there is some of this stuff that does fill in some of the gaps, but there's actually a lot of really good stuff built into the framework already for a lot of the UX problems that you're going to need to solve with inside of your application. Another thing you want to do is watch the CSS that you're writing. So there's a base set of CSS that comes with Windows 8 JavaScript applications. And these are primarily designed to skin what's already there. So to skin the out-of-the-box controls and stuff like that. You got your choice of your light and your dark theme. But they're very, very rigid in the way the CSS is written. It's very specific. Like, things have got to be in particular locations. So it will force them into particular locations. Also, as we saw, the people at the back probably couldn't see, but there is a lot of auto-generated inline CSS added. Don't try and work around this kind of stuff. It's there to try and ensure that your application looks consistent across multiple devices. I spent a lot of time trying to just turn everything out of position absolute, and then it just fell apart because the controls are designed to fit into a grid quite nicely, and they do work quite well with that. Mostly what I found the use of my own CSS for was to extend... essentially skin and retheme what's out of the box rather than trying to reposition elements on screen or anything like that. If it seems hard to do, there's probably a good reason for it because it's going to break on a smaller screen, a bigger screen, or just some variation in between. Chakra is fast. This might sound kind of silly, but my application actually failed certification because it was executing the JavaScript faster than I was realizing that it should be executing, and I just had something that wasn't dealing with a promise properly. So it was compiled in release mode when submitted to the store, and it was essentially running faster than I was aware that it was going to run, and because I didn't have my promises all configured properly, I just had some objects that don't exist, and things fell over. And I didn't find this out until I compiled in release mode. I don't actually think, I know it's not compiling anything, but the JavaScript engine is really fast, and you've just got to be careful that you don't have assumptions that things are going to take a certain period of time. So also, always make sure that you're dealing properly with your async results, because that was really what killed me most. Yes, this is COM wrapped in JavaScript. That is, a lot of the Windows 8 APIs are COM APIs under the hood. And yes, that means that we are writing JavaScript against COM. And this is something that you've really got to watch out for. Because one thing about COM is it's quite often exception-driven development. The password vault is a great example of this. If anyone noticed, I had an empty try-catch in the password vault example that I brought up before. That's because if you don't have a credential for that key when you query the password vault, it throws an exception. There's no way to check if that key exists. It just throws an exception. Well, that's really kind of annoying. Just be aware that you're going to have things. It'll just throw exceptions because that's the best way that it can deal with it. And that could get really, really tedious really fast. Particularly if you've got ReSharper because it complains about the empty catches. And some of the APIs are just not JavaScript friendly. I think they've done a great job with the APIs that have been written, but some of them I just don't understand. Tiles and badges are one of the ones that just I look at it and go, I don't understand. They are an XML document that you get back that you have to then query to find the appropriate node inside it to set the text value inside it that you then pass. This is JavaScript. Haven't they heard of JavaScript objects or anything like that? Luckily, there's a couple of APIs out there that are helping solve some of these problems. There's one called YeahToast, which is for toast notifications inside your application, and allows you to just use a much more JavaScript-friendly programming model. I wrote one called Medallion.js for doing badges on live tiles. I think I actually have that one open. It was one of the tabs I accidentally clicked on. So this is how you show a badge with inside of a Windows 8 application. As you'll see, we've got a couple of different templates we've got to select from. Then we end up with this template where I have to select a single node using XPath, and then it's like, really? XPath? That's the last thing I want to be doing inside of my JavaScript. So, yeah, just be aware that some of this stuff is just not written for us. I'm sure it works really well if you want to do XAML. I heard someone say woohoo. Shame, shame. Okay, so what about some limitations? You are running with inside the Windows 8 sandbox. That does mean that you're going to be restricted to what you have access on the device. This is not as big a deal as it is for the .NET developers in the room. If you're familiar with doing .NET development, you're going to be wanting to deal with a lot of APIs that simply don't exist. That was a really, really annoying thing that happened when I was working on a XAML-based Windows 8 application. It's like, well, why, where's that API? Particularly security, that was the one that really got us. From a JavaScript point of view, it doesn't really matter because we're not used to having the full .NET runtime anyway. That kind of would be a bad idea, I think, in the browser to have the full .NET runtime. But remember that you will have some things that you would look to do that should be simple. They're probably not going to be there. And some of the common tasks that you may want to do are really overcomplicated. Password vault is a great example. The fact that you've got to deal with just an exception that gets thrown because it doesn't have any better way to tell you that there's no value for that key. If you want to query out and get some files, then, well, you kind of got to deal with this asynchronous API that is a lot of various steps that you have to do to just be able to check if a file exists and then access it and stuff like that. So you do have some limitations from running with inside the Windows 8 sandbox. It's still technically a browser. Although I've said that don't treat this as though you're building a website, you still are running in the browser. So you are going to have some browser limitations. One thing you've got to watch out for is calls. So if you want to be doing query to services that are on the web, your APIs have got to be exposing themselves as calls-enabled APIs. This was one of the very early problems I hit with my application is I go out to a web service to bring down some data, and the API isn't calls enabled, so I wasn't able to do that because it's running on a different domain. Windows 8 applications run inside their own domain, so they're never going to have access to those web services. So if you don't have calls enabled on your web services, they are going to fall apart. One quick and dirty solution is to create a basic little Azure website and then just internally use C# to then call back to your API and make yours cause enabled until the third party makes it enabled. That's what I've had to do because the guy just isn't turning it on for his website. But make sure that you are aware of this if you are doing AJAX requests out with inside your application. And because this is still technically a browser, you've got to make sure that you're not going to have DOM manipulation errors. So if you try and like move things around in the DOM, add elements, remove elements or anything like that, before DOM content loaded has fired, you're probably going to run into some problems. IE's a little better at handling that than some of the other browsers are. So Windows 8 applications are inherently a bit better at handling that. But using the winjs.utils.ready event is a great way that if you do need to manipulate the DOM, you can wait until DOM content loaded has been executed to do your manipulations. So you don't end up with your application just crashing and it's giving you some obscure error message about the DOM. It's also technically not a browser. So it's a browser that's not a browser. There's a lot of additional events that you will get. While DOM content ready is a very important event and things like that, the events that you're going to be receiving, there's a lot more of them that are more important than content ready. The activated event is one of the most important events to be listening to with inside a Windows 8 application, because that tells you how the application has been launched. Is it launched from the search charm? Has it been launched as a sharing target? If you've got sharing enabled, is it coming back from suspend? Has it come from the application being fully terminated? Anything like that? Those events are important to listen to and react to differently because some of the WinJS APIs are not available until the activated event has executed, and because JavaScript is just executed kind of as the files are included. If you're trying to access some of those APIs and they're not wrapped inside event listeners for activated or anything like that, you will run into problems because you might not have APIs ready when you think they should be. Loaded and unloaded are actually very important when you're doing navigation. I haven't really talked about navigation because it's almost a topic on its own. The Windows 8 navigation is, it's not quite URL-based as we're used to in the web. It actually takes the contents of HTML files and kind of mashes them on top of other HTML files, kind of like a single page application, but it then somehow works out which JavaScript files and CSS files to also include. I don't really know how it works under the hood, but it's kind of scary. But the loaded and unloaded events are fired on a JavaScript, if you have a JavaScript object that matches that page name, those will get fired, and these are important when you're navigating, particularly unloaded, navigating away. So unloaded gets called when you navigate away. So if you need to tear down anything on that page, need to stop any kind of background processes specific to that page, make sure you're listening to unloaded when you're doing that. It's also important to listen to those events when you're coming back to pages from a navigation event, because they'll also get fired with different arguments to be indicative of what's happened. Checkpoint and resume. So that's when something has been tombstoned and when it's come back from asleep. So these events are also important. Although activated does get fired when an application wakes up from a tombstoning event, resumed is also fired, and it's fired after activated, and it's a lot more useful an event to listen to if you need to do something specifically. So my application, I shut down my background processes and then start them back up again once I come back from suspend using the checkpoint and resume functionality. Checkpoint and resume events. It's also stateful. Being a JavaScript web guy, I'm not really used to a stateful environment. Someone presses F5 and, well, everything's dead. You don't have to worry about someone pressing F5 inside of your application and it refreshing the page because, well, it's not technically a browser. So F5, it will only do something if you tell it to do something. So if you've got long-lived objects, they will kind of exist between, they can actually exist between page navigations. So it can be useful for passing data around between multiple pages. So that's, again, something to be aware of that from a web developer point of view, I'm not used to doing that. There's a whole bunch of new global objects. Windows is the root namespace for half of the APIs that you work with. And that annoyed the hell out of me at first because I've got window, which I'm always used to using, and then windows. And the window object is also available. So I've got window object with a lowercase w and windows object with a capital W. That just hurt my head a little bit. Binding. So binding is I've been doing some XAML work, as I said earlier, and two-way binding is actually really, really quite useful. And there is binding in the box inside of WinJS, but it's only one-way binding, which is really annoying, particularly when you're trying to build forms and data entry and anything like that. You can use KnockoutJS if you want to do two-way binding in VVM style inside of Windows 8 applications, but there are some limitations, particularly when you want to work with the built-in data source controls. These are going to be useful if you're working with grids and lists that come in the framework. You'll use the data source control, you'll build up the data source and you'll provide it to that. The two-way binding, I've had problems trying to get that working with these list controls. So you end up with kind of some knockout and just some brute force beating things until they kind of two-way bind. So just be aware that binding is there, it's not quite there though. Tooling. So Visual Studio 2012 is a really, really great improvement on JavaScript and or just web development in general, but the JavaScript stuff still has some limitations, particularly the debugging console. If you do console.log and pass in an object, I was doing this quite a lot with inside of my application, it just outputs square brackets object object, two strings it. It doesn't like deep trace it or anything like that, and I just slam my head against the desk every time it does that because I forget that Chrome and Firefox and all those kind of things actually understand that they need to kind of expand out this object. So the debugging console can really suck. If you need to know a specific property of an object, make sure you log out that particular property. Otherwise, you're just going to end up going back and changing it anyway because you don't get any useful information. But that said, I actually find the inspector with inside of it really quite useful. The CSS editor is great for tracing styles. Adding new styles is also a little bit limiting. You still got to right-click, add property sort of thing. It's not just like Chrome or Firefox where you just type and it adds a new property into your CSS. So it's good. It's better than where it was, but this is still baby steps each time. The stack traces actually work really quite well. I was surprised by this. JavaScript is notoriously bad for being able to work out stack traces. But the stack traces inside of WinJS applications actually work really quite well. The only time that you're going to run into problems with them is if you work with promises, because those are callbacks that get fired. I mean, it's done asynchronously. You're kind of limited as to where you can trace back to and then step outside. Particularly if your AJAX request just kind of falls over, you end up with just an exception that gets raised from deep within inside something that you've got no way of tracing back to what actually happened. But yeah, the stack traces are actually really quite useful and quite easy to work with. And the simulator. So if anyone hasn't realized, there's a simulator built into Visual Studio 2012 that allows you to simulate a mobile device or kind of a touch-enabled device for Windows 8 development. The simulator is reasonably good, but it's no substitute for testing on a real device. Make sure that if you are building an application for Windows 8, either in JavaScript or C#, make sure you test on at least one touch-enabled device. I found that there was some problems, particularly with the way the on-screen keyboard works in the simulator versus on a real device. The simulator's on-screen keyboard is actually smaller than an actual device's on-screen keyboard. So we were seeing, the testers were saying that things were getting overlapped, and we're like, the simulator doesn't show it overlapped, but it turns out it actually was. Also, the touch stuff with inside the simulator is a little bit flaky compared to actual devices. So just some final thoughts to wrap up. So ultimately, what's my opinion on Windows 8, HTML, and JavaScript? I mean, that's why everyone's here, to hear my opinion, isn't it? It's the most important thing, take it, yeah? This is a V1 product, really. It's good, but it's not great. It's great for a V1 product, but there's a lot of things that can really burn you quite quickly. It's really different from just trying to do traditional web development. I watched all the early videos where, as I said, people were dragging like entire websites and dumping them into Visual Studio, and hey, they had a Windows 8 style application. But well, it's not really that simple as what I found out. It's better than writing XAML, though. Cool story, bro. So, thank you. Don't forget to fill out your feedback forms and. We've got about 10 minutes left if there's any questions. Otherwise, thank you for coming.